You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there." And he answered, "Go." Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water, and he cried out, "Alas, my master, it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, "Take it up." So he reached out his hand and took it. Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, "At such and such a place shall be my camp." But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there." And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet who is in Israel tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." And he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." It was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" He said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Yahweh, please open his eyes that he may see." So Yahweh opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to Yahweh and said, "Please strike this people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Yahweh, open the eyes of these men, that they may see." So Yahweh opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Afterward, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria. And there was a great famine in Samaria as they besieged it, until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and the fourth part of a cob of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver. Now as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, "Help, my lord, O king!" And he said, "If Yahweh will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?" And the king asked her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And on the next day I said to her, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he was passing by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body And he said, May God do so to me, and more also, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today. Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Now the king had dispatched a man from his presence, but before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, Do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and hold the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? And while he was still speaking with them, the messenger came down to him and said, This trouble is from Yahweh. Why should I wait for Yahweh any longer? Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 802 of this podcast. Today is Monday, January 22nd, 2024. That means we've just got a little bit more than a week left to the first month of the new year. I just read for you 2 Kings chapter 6, and we'll talk about that here in just a minute. But also in this episode, stay tuned for what Klaus Schwab thinks we'll do instead of having elections in the future. Also, Tim Scott, senator from South Carolina, is critical of the Biden administration with regards to dependency, creating dependency, but actually making victims in the process, even as he's weaponizing the Department of Justice against Trump and Trump's allies, Trump supporters. We'll talk about the Treasury Department telling banks to flag terms like MAGA and Trump and take a special note of people who buy Bibles and shop at the Bass Pro Shop. That's where you're going to find your domestic terrorists, apparently. Also, the Supreme Court of these United States is going to possibly alter the course of January 6th defendant sentences with a agreement that they recently made to review the controversial use of felony obstruction charges. That is already upending some sentences, according to some reporting by Tom Ozimek. Gavin Newsom says that those who are critical of a California law forcing stores to have gender-neutral toy departments, they're weaponizing that law. It's the critics who are weaponizing that law. Yes, you heard that right. We'll discuss that, but we'll also discuss how all of these things taken together may be bringing us a renewed appreciation for religious freedom, the importance of religious liberty in this country. Throw in the towel on religious liberty and watch what happens. You will get a new religion, a new orthodoxy. Christianity Today has a piece from Jason Casper published January 19th. Which we will be discussing at the very tail end of this episode. But before we get into any of those news items, let's do discuss 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6 is silly. It's very odd, very strange, bewildering, but also so casual, so off the cuff. You have an axe head flying off its handle into the water in the first paragraph. As the sons of the prophets, who are kind of hanging on to Elisha, they're apparently regarding him as their leader, and they want to stay close, and he's kind of maybe perhaps taken them under his wing, but then they're like, hey, let us go over the Jordan, and each of us will get a log and make a place to dwell there. There's not enough room here where we're at right now. There's too many of us. Let's go over the Jordan. He's like, go. And one perhaps wonders if Elisha is like, finally, that would be great if you guys just go across the Jordan and live over there. Great idea. And they're like, yeah, but we were thinking, you go with us. And he's like, I will go. So he does. But then this little anecdote, this little story says that while one of them was felling a log, chopping down a tree, the axe head fell into the water. And he's all upset. He's all stressed out because he had borrowed this accent. In our day, where we still have plenty, we have less plenty than we did maybe 5 to 10 to 20 years ago, but we still have plenty. You just go to the hardware store and get a new accent. What's the big deal? It's a big deal back in Elisha's time. You don't just go down to the hardware store and pick up a new axe head for nothing. This is an expensive item. To have borrowed it, this could wreck financially the guy who couldn't afford to have his own axe head. But the man of God, that is Elisha, says, where did it fall? He wants to know. The son of the prophet shows him, and Elisha nonchalantly, casually cuts off a stick, throws it into the water there, and makes the iron float. Now, that is not how it typically works. That's not normal for iron to float, unless we're talking about mercury instead of water. But the Jordan River doesn't flow with mercury. It flows with water. And so that's not a plausible explanation. The only plausible explanation is that God supernaturally suspends the normal laws of the physical universe in this instance, per Elisha's request, to demonstrate God's power, to demonstrate again that Elisha is the prophet of God in Israel. It's a small thing, it's a trivial thing, or so it seems to us, but this would not be a trivial thing to this particular man who otherwise was going to have to figure out some way of explaining to the person he borrowed the axe head from how it was that he came to lose the axe head. I think this is a funny story, but it also goes to show that something as simple and basic as an axe head could be worth God's attention, the attention of the people of God, if that axe head represents someone potentially being ruined, if it's that valuable. Next up, though, we've got the king of Syria warring against Israel, and it says once when, so that doesn't necessarily tell us the chronology. It just happened at some point. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know exactly precisely when. Once, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel, saying, at such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware, the Syrians are going down there. Do not pass this place. You will get jumped. And the king of Israel listens to this advice and sends somebody to scope it out. And sure enough, Elisha was right. And Elisha warns the king of Israel on a regular basis like this, gives him inside information. This gets so frustrating to the king of Syria that he thinks he's got a mole. He's got somebody who has betrayed him within his own inner circle. He asks, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? How could he possibly know that we were going to do such and such a thing unless one of you told the king of Israel, unless I have a spy in my midst? His servants say, none. You know, who of us is for the king of Israel? And his servants are like, none, none of us are. My lord, O king, it's not us. It's not that. But Elisha tells the king of Israel, the words that you speak in your bedroom. Now, what's funny about what comes next is if that's true, then he's listening right now. If that's true, then he knows what you're about to do next if you go after him. But sometimes people are unreasonable like this and they don't think through what it is that they're actually putting in motion. And so they come up with a plan to go and get Elisha. And they're going to send a whole army to get Elisha and to seize him. We'll put a stop to this. Ha ha. Well, wait a second, though. Is it Elisha or is it God working through Elisha? God working through Elisha opposes you. So then if you try to go get Elisha, shouldn't you expect that maybe God's going to thwart your plan there to get Elisha? For all the same reasons that even something as trivial as an axe head falling in the water can be seized on by God to suspend the normal operation of the physical universe long enough to demonstrate that he is God in Israel, that Elisha is his prophet in Israel? Apparently that doesn't occur to the king of Syria. He sends an army. The army comes by night. They surround the city. And the servant of Elisha rises early in the morning and sees the horses and the chariots. He sees that the city is surrounded and freaks out, understandably. But then he shouldn't be freaking out any more than the king of Syria should be thinking that this is going to work. What shall we do? Elisha says, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Elisha prays and asks God to strike this people with blindness. And so God does. Now they're not able to see. Well, that's going to make it difficult for them to take the city and thereafter to take Elisha. But then, because this is comic, this whole chapter is a bit funny, a bit slapstick, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. It could just be that he who sits in heaven not only laughs, but he enjoys a good laugh, like in moments such as this. Elisha, after these Syrians are struck with blindness, Elisha says to them, this is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And what else are they going to do? They follow this voice, and Elisha takes them to Samaria. And once they're in Samaria, they are completely at the mercy of the Israelites. And the king of Israel asks, my father, shall I strike them down? He's being very respectful, but you can tell he definitely wants to strike down these Syrians. They are in his power, they are totally at his mercy, and he's not feeling especially merciful. Elisha says, no, don't strike them down. You just captured them. See? You just captured them. You've taken them captive. Here's what would be better than killing them. Feed them and give them something to drink and then send them home. Isn't that a great idea? Well, apparently it is a great idea. It's a really good idea because they're going to take word of what's happened home with them. Maybe they're not going to want to make war again against Israel, or at least they're not going to want to raid Israel moving forward. But then that doesn't mean that there's not going to be war, actually. They're not going to come on raids into the land of Israel, but there is going to be war between Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. And remember him? He was the one who was supposed to be killed. God gave him and his army into the hands of the Israelites. But then they cut a deal to put bazaars in Damascus. And the response they got after that from the prophet of God was not, hey, great job. That was smart. It was, your life will be for his life. Your people's lives will be for his people's lives. You were not supposed to let him go. You were not supposed to turn him loose like that and cut a deal. But on your own head be it. Ben-Hadad musters his entire army and besieges Samaria. And it says there was a great famine in Samaria as they besieged it. And without rereading it over again, let's just say food is scarce and we see supply and demand expressed here. The food is scarce and the money is more plentiful, or it's just as plentiful as it was before. And so what food there is, even things that are not suitable to be eaten for food. You wouldn't want to eat a donkey's head, and you wouldn't want to eat the fourth part of a cob of dove's dung. Even stuff that is not really, strictly speaking, food, because people are so hungry and they're so desperate, it's going for a premium. It's selling at a very, very high price. Now that's concerning, but it gets worse, because a woman cries out to the king asking for help. The king, at first, acts like, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to help you? If Yahweh will not help you, how shall I help you? But then maybe there's a pause, silence, no answer, and he asks, what is your trouble? She tells him a story about how she got to talking with another woman, and this woman said, let's eat your son today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son. That way it's even. That way we have something to eat. And we cooked and ate my son. And now that we've run out of my son's body to eat, this woman is not keeping up her end of the bargain. Now, this whole story, according to the woman's way of thinking, because she's apparently lost her mind and is an insane person with hunger, and this is just how evil has insinuated itself and entrenched itself, and this is, I'm sure, why Israel is at the mercy of Syria right now, because they are the kind of people who, when hungry, will do this sort of a thing, in large part because they went after the gods of the nations, and the gods of the nations routinely will require a human sacrifice, even the sacrifice of one's own children. And so you start justifying it for the sake of a religious ritual to get a favor from the gods, and it's a hop, skip, and a jump from that to just doing it yourself to get a little more sustenance, a little longer life. Keep yourself going just a little longer. What's lost on this woman and is not lost on the king is this is an insanely evil thing that you've done in cooking and eating your own son. This is just evil always round. But who does the king blame? The king blames Elisha. That'll fix it if you go and behead Elisha. This is all his fault. Was it Elisha's fault? Don't shoot the messenger. If we warned you that this was going to happen as the people of God, if we warned you that there would be disaster, there would be judgment, and you wouldn't listen, you scoffed, you laughed, you ignored, you tuned us out, you went back to your party, you went back to your socializing, you went back to your entertainment, you went back to your amusements, you went back to your vacation planning, you went back to pleasing yourself. If we warned you and you didn't listen, now that the bad things are happening, you're just so reprobate. You're so incapable of reasoning now. You've been given over to such an unreasonableness. The way you remember it is when we warned you about these things and how these things were going to happen because of your sin, because of your hardness of heart, your stiff-neckedness. When we warned you, we actually were telling you that we were going to do these things. I know that's how it works in your view of religion, that religion is just a cover for you doing things. Maybe there's a higher power involved as well, sure, but we do all the heavy lifting and the higher power maybe comes through, but even if they don't, we'll just improvise. I know that's how it works with you, but with us, when we warn you per God, because God said to warn you, and then comes the judgment, that doesn't mean that we are to blame for the coming of the judgment because we warned you. And yet, it's a sign of the times. It's a very not funny way to end what is otherwise, by and large, a pretty comical passage in several ways, because this is how religious liberty for those who love God, who serve God, who worship God in spirit and in truth, this is how religious liberty comes to be threatened. When those who are not of the people of God get desperate and they're looking for somebody to blame, they're looking for someone to scapegoat, and the closest person at hand who looks like they're doing better is someone who worships God well and truly, who serves God. And they're not under the same judgment. In the next chapter, of course, we'll get into what happens next between the king of Israel and Elisha. But for now, it's worth commenting that this is important to keep in mind. This chain of events with regards to the sorts of current events items we're going to be discussing in this episode. For instance, for starters, Andrew Chapados over at theblaze.com has a story titled, "Why Do We Need Elections? WEF Chairman Schwab Declares Voting Will Not Be Necessary Because AI Will Predict the Results." This piece was published January 19th of this year, and here is a quote from the reporting. "Digital technologies mainly have an analytical power. Now we go into a predictive power, and we have seen the first examples, and your company very much evolved into it," he told the Google founder, Sergey Brin. "The next step could be to go into a prescriptive mode, which means you do not even have to have elections anymore because you can already predict." Next, with the audience eerily silent, Schwab then asked if elections would even be necessary, given that the outcomes would already be predicted. Quote, "Afterwards, you can say, why do we need elections? Because we know what the result will be," end quote. Now, it probably goes without saying. I probably don't need to say what we're all thinking, but I'm going to anyways. Not because you can't put two and two together here to make four, but it might be helpful to have it confirmed. If you're wondering, yes, you could absolutely say that AI predicted the results and use that as a pretext for just installing and selecting whoever it is that you want to be in charge. And this is also part of what's so creepy when the corporate media calls primary races or general elections when there's 1% of the vote having been cast. In some sense, they're not reporting the news. They are acting like sheepdogs to guide the outcome, or perhaps they're letting us know that this was the outcome they wanted all along, and they're going to just go ahead and call it while it's even temporarily in that condition. They're going to call it right away, as soon as possible, as early as possible, because they just can't wait. They're impatient. As a matter of fact, when it comes to even holding elections, in the first place, they're signaling through Klaus Schwab and the WEF that they may not even have the patience in the future to keep up the pretense that we are voting for our leaders for between 10 and 20 years, at least, in the internet age. Google and other big tech have been putting their fingers on the scale to affect election outcomes, to affect primary results, and to affect general election outcomes. Google and the rest of big tech have been very much on board for the Democrats and for the globalists, for the Klaus Schwab types. They've been very enthusiastic about our democracy really being globalism and progressivism and secularism, and anybody who challenges those items, those ideas, those projects is therefore a threat to our democracy. And so it's their duty to skew the news results that show up when you do a search, skew the general search results to make websites that are critical list first, even that whole first page being all negative, emphasizing the negative, the worst things, downplaying any of the positives or reframing the positives to actually be to the credit of somebody they like or trying to make some potential future eventuality actually the bogeyman. Ah, yes, it's good right now, but it's going to be bad. Just you watch. Just you wait. They've been doing that for 15 years, if they've been doing it for five. And Klaus Schwab, I think, in this case, is signaling that they're nervous. They're nervous that if they don't just stop holding elections, if they don't just give this over to so-called predictive AI to tell us what we want, they're going to lose. They're going to lose well and truly, once and for all. They're going to be dealt a decisive blow at the ballot box, because to the extent that their policies and their ideas have been tried over the last 50 years, not just 15, you know, 15 is big tech holding a thumb on the scale or two thumbs on the scale. But for the past 50, the WEF has been operating on a global stage, enlisting more and more multinational, transnational corporations, enlisting more and more important government officials, heads of state of various countries, coordinating everybody, almost inserting themselves like a government over our governments. They're afraid that to the extent their ideas have been tried and are being credited now by the general public with disastrous results, they're going to lose elections. And I think to some extent, if they're telling us AI will predict the results, they're also admitting that AI has been predicting the results, but then they're also admitting that AI has been driving their tampering with the outcomes for some time now, to the point that they don't even think it's necessary to hold elections, but then maybe they don't want to have elections because it's scary what they're predicting now. It could be that they're predicting a major defeat for themselves and they don't like that prediction. And so you're just going to have to take their word for it, that they are shooting straight, that they're being honest. if a orderly pattern emerges when you start analyzing and assessing people en masse in the United States, in European countries, an orderly pattern starts to emerge showing that the pendulum is about to swing very heavily away from big government, globalism, open borders, making up for low birth rates among the citizens of a country by importing more and more people from foreign cultures who don't assimilate, who don't integrate. If the idea of the welfare state making all of us less well off, we are all faring actually less well because of the welfare state creating dependence. If that is showing up in their predictive analytics and they don't have anything they can do about it in time to alter the outcome, well then, yeah, I suppose just not having elections might sound pretty good to them. But it sounds ominous to people like you and me, and with good reason. Essentially, they're talking about AI as if AI is God. Artificial intelligence that they control becomes the new God, the new arbiter of democracy and global governance. And who feeds AI the prompts? Well, that's them. So then who serves as a kind of prophet for this new God of their own making? They do. This is how it probably is going to come about, that you have the end times. It's increasingly plausible. Let's just be honest. Increasingly plausible. That doesn't mean that I'm telling you that Jesus is coming back next week. I would be thrilled if Jesus is coming back next week. That's wonderful. It's very good news. Even so, come Lord Jesus. But no man knows the day or the hour that the Son of Man cometh. And yet, on the other hand, we see things like this, and we should recognize that they have very close parallels with the ungodliness, the wickedness, the war against the saints that we read about in end times prophecy in the Bible. And so that is to say, even if this is not end times, strictly speaking, we know that these sorts of attitudes, these sorts of tendencies line up with the folks who are going to be at war with God, at war with God's angels, at war with the saints in the end times. This sort of approach to governance has much more in common with paganism and having an oracle and having a priestess who speaks the words of Apollo or whoever to say this is what it must be. And if the oracle says you must sacrifice such and such a number of your own children, then how is that so different from abortion being defended, insisted upon, called sacred ground even by Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, who claims she's a Roman Catholic, but she's communicating the exact opposite of what her church has traditionally taught with regards to this. When the last defense of legalized abortion en masse, happening at scale, at an industrial scale, millions of babies murdered every year by Planned Parenthood in particular, on the encouragement and insistence of Planned Parenthood, when they defend that at the last by saying that if we don't do this, you're going to have crime go up, you'll have poverty increase, you'll have substance abuse increase, the economy will do poorer, more and more it just sounds like you're the old pagans speaking on behalf of the old pagan gods, the old false gods of the nations. If you call it AI and you say that this is science, that doesn't change the material fact that this is paganism. This is not of God. And as such, I think people like me have a right to be concerned. I am not a fan of the neo-pagans and the globalists doing away with elections because, hey, don't worry, their predictive AI has told us already who's going to win. No. Not so fast. If we were playing a board game and the predictive AI said that you were going to roll a 6 next and I was going to roll a 4 next while we're playing Risk, but you just so happened to be the one in control of the AI that was predicting that you were going to roll a 6 and I was going to roll a 4, I would still insist upon rolling, particularly when The alternative is you're like, ah, let's just, you know, say that I won that. What do you say? What do you think? Why waste time? If the more I push back and say, I am not comfortable with this, this feels like you're cheating. This feels like you might be thinking I'm stupid and also just trying to do an end run around having to risk losing the role. The more I push back, the more I insist, if you're saying it's a waste of time, the more you're going to say, ah, see, this is just further proof that you're unscientific. You troglodyte. You Luddite. You backwards, science-denying, anti-democratic, fill-in-the-blank, whatever it is we have to reach for. So you're just wasting more and more time. The longer we disagree about this, the more time we're wasting. Nah. Nope. Not cool. But we've got Tim Scott over here, a little closer to home here in the U.S., saying that Biden has made victims in need of government support, decrying the weaponization of the Department of Justice against Donald Trump, former president, and current presumptive nominee for the Republican Party in 2024. Daniel Chayton reports, January 21st, that CNN's Dana Bash pressed Scott on State of the Union to answer for his rallying cry during his own presidential run, which ended in November, when he asked supporters whether they wanted victimhood or victory, as well as grievance or greatness. Scott rejected Bash's suggestion. He was alluding to Trump. Quote, I'm actually talking about how Joe Biden has destroyed our economy and made victims out of people waiting for the government to show up, Scott said. Scott added that he was talking about having a president who is weaponizing the Department of Justice against political adversaries. A little further down, we have another quote from Scott. We need Lady Justice wearing a blindfold. I want America, every single American in every quarter of this nation, to have confidence in their DOJ, not a Biden-led DOJ. Quote, I want every child growing up in poverty like I did to have access to quality education. Unfortunately, the Democrats have sold their souls to the teachers' unions, trapping poor black kids in inner cities into failing schools and out of their best future. Quote, I want a nation where every child looks into the future and says, the American dream works for me. Quote, I was that kid. And so when I think about bringing this country together, not under grievance, but over greatness, not being victims, but being victorious, I am talking about the future of this nation and politicians who get in the way of that. End quote. These are very decent sentiments and very fair. But who are you going to believe? Me or your lying eyes? The Democrats say. Big Tech says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Let's let predictive AI tell us who should be in charge. And never mind that we are going to feed the predictive AI its algorithm and also the facts to analyze. Never mind about that. Don't worry about it. What makes me so distrustful of the idea of predictive AI replacing elections is that the same folks who are in charge of the predictive AI are also the same folks who've been censoring anybody who disagrees with the progressive, globalist, secular, modern project online. They've been boxing us out of the conversation and censoring our criticisms and our contributions for years now. So then, what's to stop them from doing the same thing with predictive AI? A Democrat party that's going to weaponize the Department of Justice against Trump and say that that's justice. A Democrat party that's going to infuse social justice into the education of K through 12 and college students across the U.S. instead of teaching them how to read, how to write, how to do math, instead of teaching those kids a true history of their own country or even a proper accounting of science. When they're going to teach social justice and a rather cult-like approach to science, a rather religious attitude towards so-called science, and they're going to silence, they're going to shut up and box out and demonize conservatives who say, that doesn't work, that's not true, that's not good. It is written, thus says the Lord, or it's in our Constitution that you're not allowed to do that. If they're going to shut up the conservatives on the internet, again and again and again for year after year after year and curate the search results and curate your social media feeds only to support their ideas. And then they offer to do the same sort of a thing with predictive AI and elections. Then I say they're only going to feed predictive AI what brings predictive AI to what they believe is the correct conclusion. Just like they want to only feed the voting public the information that they believe will bring the voting public to vote for them and their policies. They're just cutting out the middleman. That is the voting public. But then that implies strongly that their predictions increasingly point to the voting public having become rather disenchanted with them. See, that was their brand, was to disenchant all of us through deconstruction, disenchant us with the idea of being a prosperous, safe, strong country, to disenchant us with the American dream, to actually convince us that the American dream has just been a whole lot of brainwashing and propaganda and a nightmare. See, you need to wake up from the nightmare. Vote for us. If at a certain point, the American public realizes, no, the nightmare is you guys redistributing all of our material wealth, all of the fruit of our labors, all of our political freedoms, redistributing us even, or allowing uncontrolled illegal immigration to wreck our communities, it's going to be really hard to go back from that anytime soon. And maybe, Lord willing, we never go back from that disenchantment with the Democrat Party, with what it is that they were advertising, not having matched at all what it is that they delivered. Tim Scott says Biden made victims in need of government support. When you put it in those terms, maybe it doesn't sound so great. A government that's big enough to give you everything, to promise you everything and then claim that they can give you everything, is also a government big enough to take everything away from you and to hold it over your head. If you ever displease them, if you ever say no to them about anything, even legitimate, and in that case, if they've given you everything and you accepted the premise that that was theirs to give, then what's to stop them from saying, that's still ours, actually, and now you're ours as well. Now we own you. Just like the Egyptians, every man, woman, and child selling their land, their livestock, and then ultimately themselves to Pharaoh in exchange for food during 7 years of famine. Only the priests were still free and independent by the end of the famine. Everyone else was a slave. Not just the Hebrews, also the Egyptians. Now the Hebrews, they were a second-class slave, so they weren't just slaves, they were also second-class, and that was part of the game. Don't be resentful towards Pharaoh for having enslaved you all. It's these Hebrews who keep having babies. You should hate them. No. Wait a second. What if that was our food you were putting away into grain silos for 7 years of plenty, and now you're acting like that's all yours, like you personally are selling us our own food back? What in the world? When did we become dependent on you to be the one to stow this all away for the 7 years of famine? Why didn't we come up with our own storage? Would that have been upsetting? Would that have been taken as an affront to the Pharaoh? Well, then maybe this wasn't about the Pharaoh being dependable. First and foremost, it was about the people of Egypt becoming dependent. Just a thought. What's more, consider Harris Rigby's reporting over at Not the Bee. Report: Treasury Division told banks to flag terms like MAGA and Trump on statements, note Bible and Bass Pro Shop purchases to find domestic terrorists. Yeah, really. Yeah, you heard that right. The Department of the Treasury told banks, probably your bank, to flag terms like MAGA and Trump, and also take note of Bible and Bass Pro Shop purchases to find domestic terrorists. This is not my opinion. This is not Harris Rigby's opinion. This comes to us by way of Congressman Jim Jordan from Ohio. And here we have screenshotted letters with the header 118th Congress of the United States, House of Representatives, Committee of the Judiciary, January 17th, 2024. A letter to Mr. Noah Bischoff, AML officer, Platt Incorporated, inquiring, if I may paraphrase, what the heck? What? The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network is a division of the U.S. Treasury. It wanted financial institutions across the country to turn over customer and client information that could be tied to domestic extremism. In other words, FinCEN urged large financial institutions to comb through private transactions of their customers for suspicious charges on the basis of protected political and religious expression. In other words, they specifically targeted religious conservatives. They also asked to track Americans who spent money on guns and ammo, infringing on Second Amendment rights and essentially assuming that people who buy guns are domestic terrorists. And what legal grounding do the feds have for this? You guessed it. None. They just nicely asked banks to turn over this info because of suspected domestic extremism. But then, that is to say, what they regard as domestic extremism really is Americana. But then that's another way of saying the domestic extremists are you guys. And you've captured institutions and you're weaponizing those institutions against those who don't want to have their country erased from the face of the earth. They don't want Americana. They don't want an American tradition of buying Bibles and going to Bass Pro Shop to be interpreted as domestic extremism, domestic terrorism. You want to call your political opponents, your cultural opponents, domestic terrorists. You want it to be even remotely plausible. And here's another spooky thing about the predictive AI doing away with elections. If you can justify doing away with elections because AI is just going to predict it, then the next step is to do away with due process because you say due process is a waste of time. It's inefficient. We have predictive AI to forecast when you're going to be radicalized and become an enemy of the state. But then that's the gift that keeps on giving. If you feed it only the information that gives you the outcome you wanted, well, then that's not so different from what you do with climate science as well. You feed the climate models exactly the information that's going to tell you you need to seize all of the wealth, all of the political capital, all of the private economic decision-making to save the planet from global warming. You feed all of the information to your computer model or your predictive AI that's going to give you an excuse for a power grab, for a money grab, for a land grab, and for going after anybody who would object, anybody who would find that to be a problem. There's hardly any clearer example of the lengths to which this can go than the January 6th defendants. People who were just in the Capitol, not in the Capitol building, but they were just in Washington, D.C., being arrested, being held for years on the claim that they were felons. They were obstructing official government proceedings with their protest of the 2020 election results, believing that the 2020 results were skewed and that the whole of 2020 came together to paint a very dubious picture of whether we had had a normal, free, fair election like we believed was supposed to happen. Some reporting by Tom Ozimek over at the Epoch Times, January 19th, gives us some reason to be hopeful. Supreme Court action alters course of Jan 6 defendant sentencings. The High Court's recent agreement to review the controversial use of a felony obstruction charge in January 6 cases is already upending some sentences, he writes. In December, the Supreme Court decided it would take up the appeal by Jan 6 defendant Joseph W. Fisher of the Biden administration's novel use of an Enron-era evidence tampering law to prosecute hundreds of defendants for obstruction of Congress during the January 6, 2021 Capitol breach. The obstruction of Congress charge, which carries a sentence of up to 20 years in prison, is the most widely charged felony in January 6 cases, including against President Trump. Mr. Fisher was indicted for various alleged offenses for his role in the January 6 incident, including obstruction of law enforcement during a civil disorder, violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds, and obstruction of Congress based on 18 U.S. Code Section 1512C2, or tampering with a witness, victim, or an informant. That's an evidence tampering provision that's part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act which experts say was conceived largely to curb wrongdoing on Wall Street, but is now used by the Justice Department to prosecute January 6 cases. Mr. Fisher challenged the obstruction charge, claiming that 1512C2 doesn't prohibit his alleged conduct on January 6. A district court agreed, but the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit reversed that decision, siding with a broader reading of the provision, namely that it applies other forms of obstructive conduct, not just ones related to investigations and evidence. While it's unclear when the Supreme Court will hold the first hearings in Mr. Fisher's appeal, several legal experts told the Epoch Times in earlier interviews that the High Court is likely to find that 1512C2 is being improperly used against January 6 defendants. If the challenge proves successful, the Supreme Court's decision could have far-reaching consequences, potentially erasing some charges against President Trump and overturning felony convictions for numerous January 6 defendants. The implications extend beyond individual cases to the core strategy employed by the DOJ in securing convictions. Meanwhile, the fact that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear Mr. Fisher's challenge to the provision is already having an effect on some January 6 cases. Now, we'll just stop right there. You can read the rest of the reporting. A link will be in the description for this podcast episode. Feel free to go check that out. But this is a big difference from just feeding into AI what it is that you want AI to consider, to predict the results, and then saying that is adequate, whether we're talking elections or whether we're talking due process. The Supreme Court is people, individual justices who've been vetted. They've been nominated by the President of the United States. They've been vetted by Congress. They were voted on to confirm. Therefore, checks and balances being what they are, they were approved of on the front end by both the executive branch and the legislative branch at the highest levels before being installed at the highest levels of the judicial branch. And it's their role to check and balance right back. If you have some partisan members of Congress and also a very, very partisan executive in Joe Biden and his administration going after political opponents in an election year when it comes to Donald Trump, but also since the last presidential election, when it comes to just everyday common men and women who were at the Capitol. If we go away from individuals who've been thoroughly vetted and who are part of the system of checks and balances, reviewing cases like these hundreds of cases, we're in a dangerous spot, a very, very dangerous spot. If we're hands off, disinterested, don't care, let's just leave it to Google to figure out. Let's leave it to Sergey Brin and Klaus Schwab to figure out. We know what the outcome will be. I can also predict that. You don't need AI to predict that. I can predict that. The outcome will be that they always win. They always get their way because they'll only feed the machine the information that they think is relevant. But then that's why you have people checking and balancing one another in our system of government. Because when you don't have somebody cross-examining who has a different perspective, a different idea, who maybe has different interests and is not biased by trying to avoid penalties that would apply if the decision comes down a certain way, and they're not trying to pursue rewards that'll come if the decision comes down the other way, if they're not biased by those things because they have different interests, they may be more objective. That's the idea. It's not a guarantee, but it's as close as we get, humanly speaking, to a guarantee of due process. Because guess what? Some people skew justice to try and get a favorable outcome for themselves, maybe because they actually should be punished for wrongdoing. They want to point fingers at somebody else, find somebody else who should be punished. Maybe somebody else should get a reward and they're envious and they're jealous and they want that. And so they skew justice, so-called, to take a reward away from somebody who should be getting it and take that for themselves or distribute it to their friends, because then indirectly, by extension, they will get favors in return from those people that they've rewarded. You have to have people providing the checks and balances. You can't have AI except by way of people having constructed the AI. But then that is to say, if you have AI doing all of the heavy lifting, you will get foregone conclusions. You will get not just predicted outcomes, you'll get entirely predictable outcomes that we should fully expect to come down to our disfavor, especially where the folks who are saying, let's go in the direction of AI, don't believe that their political opponents are savvy at all with regards to these things. They think that we are ignorant about these things, or else they're just that desperate. Whether they believe we're ignorant or they don't believe we're ignorant, their predictions from even the information that they're selectively feeding to these systems, their information, their predictions spell disaster for their political aspirations, for them continuing to milk this cow, so to speak. But up next, I want to play for you a bit of audio, lest you just take my word for it, even my reading somebody else's articles or news reports. I want you to hear this next bit of audio and consider the way that a question is reframed and turned right around. Instead of it being accepted as a valid criticism, it gets turned into, actually, the problem is with the people who object. Here it is. Gavin Newsom, governor of the state of California, on Real Time with Bill Maher, being asked about department stores and laws that force stores to have gender-neutral toy departments. Give this a listen, and then I have some thoughts.
Well, I always said you make a great case. You know, I saw you debating DeSantis. I said, you know, I'm trying to get this guy to run for president for a long time. He looks like he'd be very good at it. What I liked with that also is that you're kind of mean, and we need that. when you need to be, not over the top. But I was on...
I appreciate that.
I was on KBLA yesterday, with my friend Tavis Smiley. I'm an investor and a supporter of that station. And I, you know, he said, who do you want for running president? I mentioned, I think you'd be good at the job. Not this year, we know. no, I know. but he said, I don't think he could win. I don't think he could win. He's too progressive, coming from this state and what he's done in this state, to win in any southern state, any red state. I disagreed, but now this is a progressive African-American-owned station, and I'm sure they like you, but he doesn't think you can win. What do you say to that? If you could win the, look at the swing state. There's only 8 of them.
Right. Well, I mean, California is an interesting case study, isn't it? It's the size of 21 state populations combined.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of the state is very deeply red. We don't need to be lectured on rural politics or border issues. I mean, in so many ways, these are familiar issues, and the issues of the heartland of the United States are very much a part and parcel of the work we're doing in this state. But look, I understand this notion that you're from the coast, you don't understand those things, you can't talk the language, you're not able to communicate, and you're not able to actually encourage and find that common ground.
No, it's stuff like there's a new law in this. I think we have way too many regulations and laws, as we've talked about, and this one, I think, says if you're a department store with over 500 employees, you have to have a gender-neutral toy department.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, I get it.
So you think that's silly? You think that's a silly thing that
we're
too much government there?
That's an interesting one, because the department stores came to us supporting that, and they were the ones making a case for that. They were making a case. They're already moving in that direction.
Wanted you to make a law about them?
Well, they supported the legislation. It wasn't legislation that was enacted, that was initiated from my office, but it was legislation that came up with interesting support from the industry itself. But I understand how that's exploited, and good people can disagree. But that's not something we woke up and said, this is a top priority for the state, when we know the top priority is homelessness, housing, the issues of crime, quality of life, and issues related to regulation and taxes, which are all top of mind. But I get how those things are weaponized.
All right, so.
fun fact, Bill Maher thinks Gavin Newsom would be a great president of the United States. So take with a grain of salt when you think he starts to sound like a conservative. Just because we may have some agreement criticizing the woke stuff, that doesn't mean Bill Maher is a conservative. And this is the whole problem with neoconservatives as well, going back decades. Just because there's some agreement being opposed to communism, for instance, for example, or wokeism, for instance, for example, that does not mean that you just go along with whatever it is that they say. You let them be the spokesperson moving forward. Be really careful about that. Speaking of selective listening, giving you the wrong impression, but also building towards foregone conclusions, Gavin Newsom is asked a question about legislation requiring gender-neutral toy aisles, gender-neutral toy departments. When asked, He turns this around and he says, actually, it was the department stores that were already moving in that direction who supported the legislation. Well, wait a second. If they're already moving in that direction, why do they need legislation? Why make a law saying everybody needs to do what we're doing? Why do that? Clearly, you wouldn't need the law if everybody was doing this. So, in other words, you have some people doing this, some corporations moving in this direction already, and they've already positioned themselves to be in compliance with the legislation. They then lobby to get the legislation passed that they're already in position to comply with ahead of time. The law is there to penalize their competition. And not just their competition for dollars, but their competition with regards to social engineering. Their competition with regards to a vision of the good life being presented even to children, even in toy departments. The legislation gets picked up and Gavin Newsom is like, oh, well, that wasn't my idea, but okay, sure, if that's what you want. But then this is just how it works with Democrats. They make a claim of representing the people, but they're representing corporations who want their competition regulated in a way that gives them an advantage over their competition. And they dress this all up as though it's virtuous, as though this is progress. How is this progress? How is this virtuous? If your competition still has a department that is separated out based on these are toys that boys typically enjoy playing with, and these are toys that girls typically enjoy playing with. And so boys will know kind of where they can expect to find the toys that they typically like playing with. Girls can know where they're going to find the toys that they typically like playing with. You would think that is top of mind for the state of California when whoever's idea it is, they make that the order of business, even for a day, even for a week. And a whole lot of controversy gets stirred up. But then something you have to understand about the way politics has worked in this country for decades is thanks to the community organizing principles laid down by Saul Alinsky, pioneered and then written out in Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky, this is exactly how you divide the general public against one another so that they're not focused on how you are actually just accomplishing whatever it is that you think is best. It stops being a reflection of what it is that the people want when you insert frivolous conflict and then exploit the chaos. Because while most people are either confused why this is even a thing, or they're fighting with each other over whether it's a good thing or it's a bad thing that it's a thing, you're busy ramming through the next thing and the next thing, or distracting from the consequences of the last initiatives that you took with regards to the economy. And again, this means that the fairly Republican idea of let's just focus on what's good for business is rather wrongheaded, and it ends up leading to the Uniparty, where the establishment of the Republican Party and the establishment of the Democrat Party does very well on Wall Street. They beat Wall Street consistently because corporations lobby for laws to be imposed on their competition, which will drive the stock price of their competition down and drive their own stock price up. And then the legislators invest before they've passed the legislation, while they're still considering the legislation, they invest accordingly based on what they know this is going to do to the stock price of this department store chain versus that department store chain. The one that's best positioned to comply with the regulations either won't be assessed fines and bad PR, bad advertising, scandal, upset, public furor, and so they'll be able to still focus on the fundamentals of their business and not take a hit in sales or the appetite of investors because they're not being fined and their competition is being fined. Or even if it's just as simple as their competition now having to change their focus from the fundamentals of good business and being competitive and selling more toys, for instance, for example, but everything else that you would have in the department store besides just toys. While their competition is scrambling to try and get ahead of the regulations being enacted and enforced, again, the corporations that lobbied for this change, this scrambling of the equation that they were ready for, the competition loses ground because they're having to reshuffle, because it's an opportunity cost to have to change up the orientation of their store, change up the layout of their store when they could have been focused on providing good customer service, better products, better engagement with the general public that comes in to buy things from them. But that's just one interesting thing about this. That's one fascinating thing about this. The other fascinating thing is that Gavin Newsom takes this criticism of his governorship and his party's leadership in the state of California, and he turns it right around and he makes it into an accusation against anybody who's critical. And he says that they're weaponizing this. Wait a second. Wait. Now you're trying to dilute the potency of the term weaponization, because you know that weaponization is how Republicans are describing what the Department of Justice, for instance, or even some minor part of the Treasury Department, what they're doing in going after people for shopping at Bass Pro Shops or buying Bibles or purchasing any kind of representative apparel and merchandise that would have to do with support for Donald Trump. That's how we're going to find the domestic terrorists, potentially. The Democrats are saying, Joe Biden is saying, the Department of Justice under Biden's administration is saying, and Republicans call that weaponization. And so what Gavin Newsom has done very cleverly here is he's co-opted the term weaponization either to say, oh, I know you are, but what am I? Or to rob the term of any potency. To be critical of Gavin Newsom and the Democrats in California, for the general public to be critical of Gavin Newsom and the Democrats in the state of California, is not weaponization of their bad choices. That's the role of the general public, especially when it's time very soon to make another decision about who's going to govern us moving forward. How are we going to make decisions together moving forward very shortly? That's the role of the voting public to examine and to scrutinize. Are you doing a good job to this point with the authority we've invested in you, with the credibility and the oversight you currently have over our daily affairs? Are you already doing a good job? If not, where are you not doing a good job? And could somebody do a better job than you're doing right now? If passing laws to require the competitors of department stores who have already gotten ahead of the legislation, and they have this vision of the good life that they want to express through their layout of the store, particularly to young children, if the competitors being then penalized through a perverse form of lawfare and dirty dealing, a perverse form of grift, if that's not something you're allowed to criticize, or actually, if you do criticize it, you're now potentially an insurrectionist or seditious or treasonous, traitorous, dishonest, all the rest. Well, then, yeah, I suppose we do get something of an idea of what it would look like for Gavin Newsom to run for president and be president. He makes much of how populous his state is. But then remember, even as he brags about how many people in the state of California are rural and are more conservative, and they're doing just fine, California is hemorrhaging people. They are losing a lot of people because people frustrated, throwing their hands up, scared, impoverished, less free, less safe, are leaving the state. And they're not leaving the state of California and going just anywhere. They're going, in many, many cases, to states like Texas and states like Florida, run by Republicans, led by Republicans, who, yes, with their faults, warts and all, are not perfect, but their principles are much better. Their principles are much more in accordance with individual liberty, individual self-determination, being able to enjoy the fruits of your labors instead of those being harvested from you and given to illegal immigrants and the homeless and drug abusers and, yes, corporate grifters. But this is all in the mix too, because with regards to the criticism of Tim Scott for Joe Biden's administration, that people have been made more dependent on Joe Biden, but that's actually harming them. They're being impoverished. They're being made less safe so that then Joe Biden can come in and say, ah, see, I'll save you. Considered right alongside the Supreme Court reviewing a novel use of legislation that was really supposed to be about tampering with evidence, not about showing up to protest an election that you feel was fraudulent. Considered alongside Klaus Schwab saying, predictive AI, Google, you should really see if you can make your predictive AI replace elections to where we just don't even have to have elections, say, for instance, in the United States. You consider this interview with Gavin Newsom and what he's saying alongside that, alongside those stories, those developments, and I think you only get more reason to distrust the idea of predictive AI deciding who's going to govern the country moving forward. Watch predictive AI be touted as pointing to an inevitability of Gavin Newsom winning the presidency if he runs in 2028, for instance. Watch for predictive AI to predict exactly the results that the progressives want, but which came first, the chicken or the egg? Which came first, them wanting these things and wish casting these things into existence through AI, or AI assessing and evaluating what the general public wants and then saying, ah, see, yeah, it looks like most people agree with you. You progressives, you globalists, you big government types. This is how it works. And they prefer, on the left, predictive AI being a god, like a golden calf. Ah, behold, your gods who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. They prefer that infinitely to individuals making decisions about the well-being of their own households, their own selves, yes, but their families, their children in particular. They prefer that AI would become a new god to us over religious conservatives in the U.S. buying Bibles and shopping at Bass Pro Shops and representing Make America Great Again trucker hats. And that right there should tell you everything you need to know about who to vote for and who to pray hard is not making the governing decisions, not leading by example or any other way moving forward in this country. But let's do consider, as I said we would, let's do consider a piece of reporting in Christianity Today by Jason Casper. January 19th is when this was published of this year. This was sent to me by my neighbor two houses down, JP Chavez. Everybody, give JP Chavez a pat on the back and a handshake and a hearty thank you when you see him next for sending great material like this, finding great material like this and sending it my way so that I can share it with you. Report: support for religious freedom rebounds in America. The fifth annual index by a leading law firm finds that friendship is key to maintaining gains amid polarization and the shifting emphasis of Gen Z. Casper writes, American support for religious freedom is trending in the right direction. Rebounding from COVID-19 lows in 2020, the Beckett Religious Freedom Index registered a new high in 2023 in its annual monitoring of First Freedom Resilience in the United States. Amid widespread political polarization, core support for the right of individuals to live according to their faith remains strong. Quote, despite some efforts to turn religion into a scapegoat for our nation's problems, most Americans believe that religion and religious freedom are key to solving them, said Mark Rienzi, president and CEO of Beckett. Quote, as we celebrate Religious Freedom Day, we should remember that religious liberty remains the cornerstone of our effort to form a more perfect union, end quote. Results were released on January 16, marking Virginia's 1786 passage of the statute for religious freedom, which became the basis for the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Initially led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the day has been commemorated in the United States ever since a presidential proclamation in 1993. Either three centuries or 30 years later, there should be no sky-is-falling narratives about American culture, summarized the report. Featuring 21 questions across six categories, the annual index measures perspectives on the First Amendment. Now, in the report's fifth year, Beckett polled a nationwide sample of 1,000 Americans in October, scoring their opinions from zero, complete opposition, to 100, robust support. The composite score is 69, 1 point higher than last year and up 3 points from 2019. Beckett's report asserts the religious impulse is natural to human beings and therefore religious expression is natural to human culture. Through its law firm, the group defends religious rights. Through its index, Beckett discovers if Americans agree. Questions are repeated each year to measure consistency across detailed application. Support for religious pluralism measured 84 on a 100-point scale, experiencing a 7-point increase since 2020. This category gauges popular support for holding beliefs about God, adhering to a religion, and living out the basic tenets of religion in daily life. Support for religious sharing measured 72%. The second highest category explores the extent to which people should be free to share their religious beliefs with others, but shows sharp divides between the religious and non-religious. Support for religion in action measured 68. With statistically significant half-point gains since 2019, this category studies the freedom to practice beliefs beyond the walls of the home or place of worship. Support for religion and policy measured 66%, the only category not to score an all-time high. It probes the proper place of religion in crafting law and public policy. Support for religion and society measured 65, up 3 points from last year. This category reviews the contributions of religion and people of faith to the creation of healthy communities. Support for church and state measured 59, also up 3 points from last year. This most controversial category examines the boundaries of interactions between government and religion. Beyond the questions that populate these categories, the index also gauged religious liberty opinions on three additional topics that test the levels of overall support. Two suggest pushback against a liberal ethos. First, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, 30 years after its passage in 1993, still commands respect. About two-thirds of Americans agree that its level of protections are just about right, 63%. Amid some claims that state-level versions of the law are used to undermine LGBT rights, this community is even more likely, 65%, to agree. Only 12% of survey respondents believe the act goes too far, while 26% believe it does not protect religious freedom rights enough. Second, Americans support faith-driven parental rights to opt out children from curriculum on gender and sexuality. Nearly three-quarters, 74%, agree, with strong agreement, 42%, four times higher than strong disagreement. Meanwhile, 58% of Americans oppose school policies mandating preferred pronouns usage in schools, a 12-point increase from 2021. Quote, the American people sent a clear message in this year's index. Parents don't take a backseat to anyone when it comes to raising their children. Parents want schools to teach their children math and science, not force them to embrace controversial gender ideology, end quote. Now, there is more to the Christianity Today reporting by Jason Casper. You can go ahead and read that. I'll put a link in the description for this podcast episode. Check it out if you want to find out more, according to Jason Casper. But here's what I'll say. When public policy, when culture, when the legislative process begins to blur or else dissolve the lines distinguishing between what you do in your own home with regards to your religious convictions, what you do in your church or your other place of worship with regards to your own religious convictions, and what is considered to be the interest of the public. That's when we find the failure point in saying religion should just be a private matter. When Democrat-run states pass legislation threatening to take children away from parents whose kids in the public schools come home saying, I actually prefer female pronouns now, even though I'm a male. I actually prefer male pronouns now, even though I'm a female. And the parents say, we are not going to affirm that. In fact, we want to get you out of the public schools because we thought we could make this work, but we were wrong. When Democrat-led, Democrat-governed states make it law that they will take your children away from you for not affirming gender ideology and transgenderism that the schools are pushing on children, we realize more needs to be said about the role of religion in public life than just that's your own business. Oh, okay. Well, what about my job as a parent? What about my role in the lives of my children? What about my authority in the lives of my children? What if my religious convictions inform not just rights, but duties that I take very, very seriously, and I can't check those at the door when I jump in my car to drop my kids off at school, or I jump in the car to go to work, or I jump in my car to go anywhere outside of my own private property? We have to think more carefully about these things, because the folks that we are in competition with for the hearts and minds of our children are trying to stay always one step ahead of us. And if they can't at the ballot box, they're already signaling that maybe, just maybe, they use technology to bring an end to our even being able to vote. Predictive AI will just decide who's best for us. The time is running out. If we think this will all just blow over, let's see how another election cycle or two will go. Time is running out. When they start combing your bank records for what you privately were purchasing, conflating somehow, some way, you buying Bibles with you potentially being a domestic extremist, a domestic terrorist, you have to admit that they don't respect even your private right to being religious. On the off chance that your private exercise of your First Amendment rights might turn into opposing them in public, they're getting your bank statement data combed through by the banks, by the way. It's the banks that will comply with this sort of a thing, just like it's the department stores in the state of California that will lobby the government of the state of California to pass laws that go after their competition. Yes, banks too will comply with these rules. Big tech will absolutely comply with these rules. In fact, they'll be the biggest champions. Why? Because if they're in agreement with the progressive program, they win. That's how they win, is by singling you out, by going through your private data, even going through your private correspondence to look for terms and to flag them, just as easily as that can be fed into targeted advertising of products and services. It can also be directed towards harming your reputation, clipping your wings with regards to political engagement. If they know that behind the scenes you're motivated by your religious convictions, then they know exactly the right questions to ask. They know exactly where to fish to catch the big one, to make sure you don't ever get off the ground. And if they're talking about it openly, that they maybe should plan to do that in the near future, because that's how good predictive AI is going to be. Rest assured, that's what they've already been doing with AI, quietly, privately, secretly, for the greater good, you know, just testing it. And they're trying to test to see, now, will we accept that? If we will accept that because we say, my religious convictions have no bearing on public life, everything is on the table for what they might take away from you and who they might take away from you. Because the next thing, after they've decided you don't need to vote anymore, the next thing is they decide you don't need to be the one raising your children either when you have these convictions. You have these religious convictions? Meh. No, that's not what's best for the child. That's a hateful and discriminatory and bigoted view. If they can say it's a hateful, bigoted, discriminatory, and unacceptable position to take in the workplace, at your school, you can get fired, you can be expelled. If you accept that, if you agree with them on that, the next thing is they say it's also unacceptable in your own home if you're teaching your children that. And so we're just going to take away your children if these are your views, if these are your positions. You have to know that. You have to understand that. I think the polling numbers cited here by Jason Casper's Christianity Today piece are a hint that at least single-digit percentage numbers of Americans may be getting wise to that fact, maybe starting to realize that that's actually where this is supposed to go next. But the number of Americans who still are adamantly opposed, it's still far too high of a number. And oh, by the way, did you catch at the beginning here how these numbers are rebounding after religious folk having been scapegoated in 2020 and 2021? Doesn't that sound an awful lot like 2 Kings chapter 6? The king of Israel hears of this very disturbing, horrifying even, complaint of a woman who cooked and ate her own child. And now she's upset that the woman she cooked and ate her own child with is hiding her child from this woman. That's not fair. You're reneging on our agreement. Which is more sacred? Your agreement that you never should have made in the first place, or your responsibility to your child who you just murdered and ate? Well, never mind about all of that. As far as the king of Israel is concerned, he needs somebody to blame. He needs somebody to turn this around on. Maybe he'll say Elisha has weaponized the misbehavior of his administration over Israel. This is all Elisha's fault. Don't you see? He said this was all going to happen. He made it happen. He warned us that this was going to happen. He hasn't been compliant. The only reason it didn't succeed is because people like Elisha, people who listened to Elisha, wouldn't get with the program. And it's our disunity that has made us so vulnerable. And that's why this woman just ate her son and wants to eat the other woman's son and is asking me about it, wanting my help, wanting me to intervene. There is no new thing under the sun. And just like the king of Israel's first impulse is to blame and scapegoat Elisha, so also the godless radical leftists in our country in 2020 and 2021 and even on up to the present, when they've been confronted with the most disastrous effects of their bad decisions, their first instinct has been to scapegoat the conservative Christians. It's all our fault, apparently. If it wasn't for January 6th, if it wasn't for people buying Bibles and shopping at the Bass Pro Shop, it doesn't even make any sense. Was that a valid criteria for figuring out who the domestic terrorists are? It doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't have to make any sense to people who have been given over to a reprobate mind. They have rejected the truth about God, and they hate, therefore, those who live by the truth about God, who live and die by the truth about God. And because they're so stubborn and so rebellious, and they're not willing to admit that they're wrong, especially the more wrong they are and the more disastrous the results are, because they're so terrified of the negative consequences of their actions that they know will have to come, either humbling themselves or taking some penalties, repaying to those they have defrauded what it is that they took wrongfully, they continue on acting according to their nature, and they hate the conservative Christians more and more and more and more. And at a certain point, this just turns outright murderous. And I've been warning about that for some time now. But you have to know that that's where it goes. If you carry this narrative forward to its logical conclusion, we see this pattern is already anticipated in the scriptures. And if we believe that there is no new thing under the sun, we have to admit that this repeating pattern, when these are the dynamics, these are the players involved, this is where they are choosing to plant their flags, we have to know that the next thing that happens is the violent suppression of the people of God, because it's all their fault. You build up the case that it's all their fault, all of the problems in the world. Every transgendered child who commits suicide was actually murdered by a conservative Christian who said, I believe what the Bible says about male and female and our sexuality is the truth and good, and it's beautiful. Ah, okay, well, now you're a murderer. See? What do we do with murderers? Well, we put them to death. And if we predict that you're going to lead to the death of a transgendered person or a homosexual who commits suicide because you believe what the Bible says about such things, if we predict that, then it gives us a pretext for coming after you to prevent you doing this thing. See, we're actually protecting life in our own minds. Just like they twist abortion into somehow being healthcare, they'll also twist the violent persecution of Christians into somehow being the protection of the innocent. But this is because they're of their father, the devil. Put simply, Amazon, and we'll talk about this in our next episode, but Amazon.com has a new kids show out, which is straight up Satanism. Satan is the misunderstood hero. He is Prometheus bound. And that'll be a great time for us to talk about Prometheus bound by Aeschylus, by the way, which I read very recently. But essentially, they superimpose the myth of Prometheus from ancient Greek times onto Lucifer in the Bible. And they say, Lucifer was just misunderstood this whole time. God and the angels loyal to God, they're the villains of this story. Where does that go? If you admit that there's a war, and then you say you're on the side of the enemies of God, well, then you will also definitely be an enemy to the people of God. And so they will. And we should brace ourselves for that fact. I don't think it can be avoided at this point. In fact, I don't think we've been avoiding it. I think we've been in the thick of it. And a lot of folk who have tunnel vision and they're navel gazers and they don't want to get into any current events talk. They want to study the weather reports from hundreds of years ago, but they don't want to look up at the sky and see what time it is now, whether we have a storm rolling in over the mountains today. Those folk have been saying for years, no, there's no persecution in America. You don't recognize it. It's coming. And in some quarters, it's already here. When parents can have their kids taken away from them for being conservative and for being Christian and for teaching their children what the Bible says about male and female and about sexuality, it's here. It's not just coming. It's here. If you and I have reason to believe that we could lose our jobs and our livelihoods would be forever altered because we were fired, we were terminated for expressing these convictions, being known to be associated with these convictions. If we reasonably suppose that, because it does happen, if we're being put on terrorist watch lists for buying Bibles, if we're being put on terrorist watch lists, if we show up to a school board meeting and complain about graphic sexual content in the books in the children's library at the school, persecution's not just coming. It's here, and there's no sense denying it. It's an either or. Either you believe that your religion is a private matter, in which case they will define down more and more and more to nothing what is regarded as your private business. And the hint is, look at all the things they regulate. They regulate literally everything. Seizing the means of production is seizing you. There is no such thing as other people's children. The president said it himself. Well, then you can't be safe. You won't be safe, and you're not safe. You haven't been safe to this point, saying, well, that's just my private business. What I believe about God, that's just my private business, and I'll just manage my own affairs. Nope, no, 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 no. The business of making decisions together, the welfare of the city is your business, in part. And what's funny is the enemies of God's people know this. And if they didn't believe that there's a very strong case to be made in that direction, they wouldn't be working so hard to propagandize the opposite and to box out and to isolate and to stigmatize anybody who would express what they're calling Christian nationalism. If Christian nationalism includes but is not limited to shopping at Bass Pro Shops and buying a Bible and even just being present in the Capitol on January 6th, being present in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, well then, what they're really opposed to is you being a Christian, not just your Christian faith affecting policy. They're really concerned about you being a Christian, and you need to knock that off. Stop it. Because they know that it's going to inform how you vote, how you engage, how you relate, how you educate your children, how you raise your children, if you have children at all. If they know that better than you do, well then, are you good with them always being five steps ahead of you, always thwarting you, boxing you out, excluding you from the economy? Is that the responsible course? Is that the righteous course? Is that what Scripture calls us to? I'm not so sure. For our last bit of current events to consider for this episode, I'll leave you with a reading of a letter from the Presbyterian Church in America to the U.S. government. Listed here on this letter dated January 21st, 2024, is the Honorable Joseph R. Biden, Jr., President of the United States. The Honorable Mike Johnson, Speaker, U.S. House of Representatives. The Honorable Chuck Schumer, Majority Leader, United States Senate. The Honorable John G. Roberts, Jr., Chief Justice, Supreme Court of the United States. The Honorable Hakeem Jeffries, Democratic Leader, U.S. House of Representatives. The Honorable Mitch McConnell, Republican Leader, United States Senate. Dear leaders of the United States government, we, the Presbyterian Church in America, the largest body of confessional Presbyterian and Reformed churches in North America, consisting of more than 1,500 congregations and 374,000 members across the United States and Canada, humbly petition you to protect the lives and welfare of minor children from the physical, mental, and emotional harms associated with medical and surgical interventions for the purpose of gender reassignment. Furthermore, we call upon you to use your positions to promote the health, bodily integrity and well-being of minors who are suffering from gender dysphoria and related conditions. We recognize the growing nationwide distress and concern over interventionist practices targeting children. While we acknowledge complexities around these issues, we share those concerns and urgently appeal to you to protect the nation's children. The basis for our appeal is that all people, young and old, male and female, are created in the image of God. Genesis 1:26-27, James 3:9. This unique status accords all human beings with inherent dignity, a dignity that extends to both soul and body. For over 2,000 years, the Christian Church, in all her branches, has stood on the teaching that the value of the human body arises from its source, which is from God, and its purpose, which is to bear God's image. We believe current gender reassignment interventions for children are not in keeping with the high value of human bodies, a value determined not by circumstance, ability, or human judgment, but by the determination of our wise Creator who constituted each person, a body, soul, unity. Genesis 2:7, Psalm 139:13-16. We also ground our humble petition in God's love for children. He expressed his love when the Son of God said, "Let the children come to me, do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God." Mark 10:14, ESV. Indeed, his deep love for children is revealed in comparing them to those who are greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Because of this love, it is a grave sin to harm children. Matthew 18:1-6. In his kindness, God has provided parents and the civil magistrate for the protection of children. Ephesians 6:1-4, Romans 13:1-4. Until recently, an obligation to protect children has been widely acknowledged in Western society. The duty to protect children from harm is to be met by authorities in familial and civic contexts who recognize the vulnerabilities unique to childhood. While these vulnerabilities can be preyed upon by powerful external forces, they are also susceptible to the internal confusions and instabilities often accompanying childhood. As Christians, we recognize that we live in a fallen world in which some children and adults experience a perceived incongruence between their biological sex and their internal sense of gender. These feelings of gender incongruence cause severe psychological distress, often associated with debilitating anxiety and depression. We genuinely sympathize with the parents and loved ones of those who experience this kind of suffering, many of them in our churches. However, experts disagree on the nature and causes of gender dysphoria. Persons who try to change their biological sex through the process of transitioning, including psychotherapy, lifelong hormonal treatments, and extensive non-genital and genital surgeries, are attempting the impossible. This reality merely reflects the divine design as God created human beings distinctly male and female, Genesis 1:27, Matthew 19:4, Mark 10:6. Since the sexual binary is rooted in creation and determined by God, it cannot be changed. Therefore, it is not surprising that transition attempts carry many long-term risks. Among these risks, which are often irreversible, include conditions such as sterility, infertility, cancer, cardiovascular disease, strokes, blood clots, pituitary, apoplexy, pseudotumor, cerebri, and diminished bone density. For children, the stakes are even higher. Since the brain has not yet fully developed during puberty and adolescence, minor children are not mentally and emotionally ready to give informed consent to life-altering and non-reversible medical procedures. And with the increase in depression, anxiety, isolation, and alienation of children and adolescents in the United States and Canada, exacerbated by the use of social media and, more recently, COVID-19 policies, young people often experience fluctuating emotions and internal confusion. Teenage girls especially have been susceptible to rapid-onset gender dysphoria, a recent phenomenon involving large numbers of teen girls claiming to have gender dysphoria. The increased diagnosis of gender dysphoria in girls has been driven by social contagion from current social, educational, and cultural influences. Children whose minds and personalities are still developing do not yet possess the perspective or maturity to make these irreversible decisions. They should be given time to accept their biological sex, which occurs in the majority of teens allowed to progress through natural puberty. Although we respect the expertise of medical professionals, it is striking that traditionally medical students had to affirm the Hippocratic Oath, which includes the commitment, "I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, especially from abusing the bodies of man or woman." This priority of not harming others is ultimately grounded in the triune God who is love, 1 John 4:8, from whence he calls us to love each other. Reflecting this nature of God, one of the greatest commandments is that we love our neighbors as ourselves, Matthew 22:39. As Scripture states, love does no harm to a neighbor, Romans 13:10. Cross-reference, Exodus 20:13. Providing medical intervention for the purposes of transitioning does irreversible harm and injustice to all people, but especially minor children. For these reasons, we condemn the practice of surgical and medical gender reassignment, especially of minors, and we humbly petition you to protect the lives and welfare of minor children. Sincerely, members of the commission appointed by the moderator, 50th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in America, PCA. This right here, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. This right here is the responsibility of the church. When Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth, but salt that has lost its savor is good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled under men's feet," this is being salt. When he says, "You are the light of the world, but nobody lights a lamp and hides it under a bushel, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden," this is part of what it means in our day to be a city on a hill. To believe that this sort of engagement is inappropriate, that is not from God. That's from Satan. He's always been a liar. It's a lie. Don't believe it. But that's all the time I've got for this episode. I've got to run. In our next episode, we will be discussing the Barbie movie. You won't want to miss it. But like I said, I've got to run. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless. You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.